I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Theo Pauline Nestor. Her new book is called Writing is My Drink, a writer's story of finding her voice and a guide to how you can too. She will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Wednesday, the 4th of December, doing not only a talk and book signing, but also a writing class for one and all. And then on Friday, December 6th, there will be a one-day writer's intensive workshop, the Black Mesa Writer's Intensive. Welcome, Theo, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be here again.
Good to see you. We had you on talking about your memoir several years ago. I think it was called Sleeping Alone in a King-Size Bed. And this is a wonderful book about writing, which is a bit of your own memoir. And you start in this amazing place, which is something that I think a lot of people, particularly women of our generation, can relate to, which is that you have to go through almost like a recovery program from being a good girl.
That's such a perfect way to put it. Yeah, at the beginning of the book, what I say is that two competing forces have dominated my life, a great need to please others and an equally powerful desire for expression. And the story really is about recovering from being a good girl and recovering from growing up with, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. And the limitations that that put on me as a person who had something I wanted to express.
And you give kind of a shocking example of that, which I know is a little bit awkward for you to talk about, but basically you were trained to be so incredibly polite that one moment when a horse stepped on your foot, you suppressed the urge to cry out, and just eventually when the conversation had a break, you said, excuse me, there's a horse on my foot.
Yeah, I mean, that story that I start the book with, it's become sort of a personal symbol for me to how bad the problem really was. Sort of, you know, when you have this kind of, you know, free-floating self-doubt, sometimes it's, you know, hard to sort of really know, like, is, you know, am I making this up, or is this really a struggle that, you know, bears having my attention put to it? And when I think of that story, that as a child I was so, you know, eager to stay in line that I wouldn't even say something when I was in pain, it just was always sort of a touchstone for me to remember, yes, it's that bad. I was that shut down.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's what's very interesting and I think very useful and important is the way that being good gets in the way of telling the truth. And this is what you've had to basically do, is kind of go through like a recovery from being good, which doesn't mean that you're bad or rude or impolite or whatever, but you basically have to go to a really different mindset in order to be able to tell the truth about your life, which it is important to do.
Well, and especially if you want to be a writer. And I think it started, you know, the real friction in this started coming up for me when I hit college, particularly my second year of college, because I started working for the student newspaper, and I fell in love with the written word, but especially I loved bold personal narrative. I loved James Baldwin, loved Gloria Steinem, loved Erica Jong, and all these writers I admired had this one thing in common, which was they were very daring, and they were very bold, and they were unflinching, and I was a flincher. So it was, you know, I wanted to be basically the opposite of what I had been trained to be, which is, you know, obedient and towing the line. And that's sort of, when this friction began in me.
So this friction began, what did you do?
Well, I kept trying. I think what I kept doing is I kept trying to write and failing. I mean, part of it is that I was young. But, you know, I think it first started showing up when I was working on the student newspaper and I was taking creative writing classes in college, and then later when I first applied to do a graduate program in writing. I had this great desire to write, but my writing was not very good, and not just because I didn't have the mastery over the language that writing requires, but because I was so reticent and I was so hesitant to talk about, you know, the harder things in life that it's especially in personal narrative, that's what the reader is going to look for. They're going to personal narrative because they want that communion that happens between writer and reader when the writer is that intimate, is that open about their experience. And I wanted to do that, but I couldn't. I was absolutely blocked from being able to do it.
And readers can smell that a mile away.
They can. Absolutely bored. You know, if you're holding back or you've got sort of like a mystery, you know, a mysterious approach in personal narrative, no one, you know, publishers don't want to buy it, and editors don't want to run it, readers will put it down. It's not what they're coming to personal narrative for. They don't want you to be coy.
Right, and in your case, it wasn't about being coy. It was really about not having yet gone through the process, which is often, for people, both difficult and sometimes painful of learning to really speak the truth, and a lot of people need help. How did you find the help you needed, so to speak?
Well, I think, so instead of going into MFA program that I wanted to do in my 20s, because I applied to one program, I didn't get in. I ended up doing a master's in literature. So I'm studying other people's writing, which was feeling much safer to me. But it was during that time that I started to really become depressed for the first time. And I went into therapy, and it was in therapy that I basically realized sort of, you know, one truth that was really dictating sort of the course of my life and who I was, that not only had I not named, but nobody in my family had named, which was that my mother had a drinking problem and was most likely an alcoholic. And that, even though she, is sort of what one would not characterize as a falling down drunk, there was this constant presence of alcohol, which meant that my mom wasn't available. And this is something that, certainly my generation, I'm 52, it's a very common experience because the World War II growing up, coming of age generation, drinking was just like a way of life. It was just very pervasive. But it somehow changed my experience about being able to connect with my mom. And yet it had been, until that point, unnameable. Once I named that, and this happened when I was about 28 years old, it was the beginning of a turning point. It was because it was the one true thing that I had to name before I could start going forward.
Very interesting. You were talking about generations, and I think that there's something about growing up in the 60s and 70s, specifically for women, that for so many people has required either like therapy or recovery or memoir writing or something like that in order to just really claim who you are, not to mention reading feminism or whatever your specific thing is. What do you think is going on in that generation?
Well, I think that, there were so many mixed messages. Like, one of the things I think about my parents' generation, my parents were both born in 1927, so they both came of age right in the middle of World War II, and their childhoods had been shaped by the Depression. So they had lived through two things that were, levels of distress that were, much different than anything I've experienced in my lifetime, that were, experienced not only across the culture, but cross-culturally, worldwide even. And so I think, I always point to the movie The Graduate as just like such a beautiful example of the rift between the World War II coming-of-age people and their children. And because they had such a premium, that generation, on keeping a stiff upper lip, it just seems natural that the next generation, there we go into the 60s and the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the women's movement, all these movements that were about speaking your truth came bubbling up into the culture. And when I think of my childhood, I think about both of those forces just being so alive. I grew up in the Bay Area in California. I had an older sister, older half-sister Susan, who was hanging out with the Grateful Dead and running off to San Francisco to do all sorts of fun stuff. You know, Angela Davis was on the news, you know, beads and incense and hippies, speaking your truth was everywhere. And then at the same time, I lived pretty much by myself with my mom, who could have been a character on Mad Men. I mean, she's sort of in sheath dresses, having cocktail parties on the patio, and, you know, very much sort of that, you know, World War II generation sort of coming into being in California in the 1960s. And it was, so I had both, you know, this be a good girl, like daughter of the, you know, my mom, so I'm in patent leather shoes and little white anklets. And then in the culture, there's this explosion going on that I'm too young to be a part of, but I'm very much witnessing. And the message of that culture is, for one, self-expression and that personal experience matters.
So when you, I mean, now you are teaching writing, what do you see and how is it the same and how is it different in the young women who are now like in their, for example, in their 20s?
One of the things that's interesting about my teaching, Mary Charlotte, is that I teach for a continuing education program at the University of Washington. So actually my students are primarily women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so because I'm not teaching, you know, the young generation, I'm teaching, you know, pretty much my peers generationally. And what I see in them is myself. And actually that was a lot of how I came to write this book. Because I used to think this was just like my personal story of struggle and that, you know, that the family legacy of alcoholism had contributed more to this than anything else. But in watching my students, I realized, oh, no, I was part of an epidemic. And it's interesting because each of them seems to think, like I did, that it's their individual struggle. And they'll say this to me things very much like I said at the top of the interview, you know, about having this desire to express, but being afraid, being very worried about how their family was going to receive their writing. And just, you know, hearing this, like, student after student, year after year, I started just, you know, cluing in, like, wow, this is something much, much larger than myself and something that I think needs to be addressed.
We're talking to Theo Pauline Nestor about her book, Writing is My Drink. Now, why did you call it that?
Okay. Well, that was a sort of an odd convergence of factors. So about 4 years ago, I discovered Al-Anon, which is a 12-step program for friends and family of alcoholics recovering from the effects of alcohol. And in meetings, in one meeting in particular, I remember hearing this expression, which is, worry is my drink. And the idea behind it being that for people who have, you know, spent a lot of time in situations with alcoholism, their reaction to it is to take on sort of obsessive worrying rather than obsessive drinking as sort of a reaction to alcoholism. And that just, you know, kind of just got into my imagination. And then at that same time, I was wanting to start a blog about writing. And I was actually reading this book by Christina Katz, and it's a book called Get Known Before the Book Deal. It's actually a book I'd really recommend for writers who are about to promote a book. And she was talking about how in a blog, like, you don't want to have something general. You want to have something that's like a niche. So instead of writing, having a blog just about writing, you want it to be, you know, one particular aspect. And then just sort of like in a weird lightning bolt moment, I thought, oh, writing is my drink. My blog is going to be about finding my voice. And this very experience that I'm talking about, this sort of contradiction of, you know, wanting to express and yet at the same time wanting to appease others. And so that became my blog. And then a few years later, or maybe a year later, I had the idea of turning the blog into a book.
I thought that one of the really interesting parts of this book was you're talking about, and I mean, you describe in many different kinds of detail the lack of confidence that you had as a young person, and you know, you were both going forward with this desire to be a writer and stepping back from it because you didn't have the confidence. And one of the things that really brought you forward was teaching. It was kind of like a boot camp for really owning your own voice.
Yeah. This sort of result of doing this master's in English literature was the result I wanted, was I got a job teaching in a community college. And, you know, I wanted to be a professor, right up there with wanting to be a writer. But what I didn't sort of, you know, anticipate was that being a professor meant you were professing. You were up in the front of the room. You were the authority. You're the person, you know, sharing the knowledge. And that would actually require, again, something for me that emotionally I wasn't really ready to do, because I still, you know, I brought that self-doubt that I had into the classroom. But I had a very rigorous teaching schedule as community college professors do. I taught, I think, three classes a day. And, you know, students didn't care if I had self-doubt. Like, they just want to learn the stuff. They're there. They paid the money. And, you know, teaching that many classes a day, I got over it fairly quickly, because it was just like, here you are, you're in front, you've got to lead the discussion, you've got to give your opinion. So I think teaching did a lot for me in just building my self-confidence in what I have to say.
And then you got to that point in teaching, which you talked about earlier, which is basically teaching people your age and having this feeling of seeing yourself in them and them seeing themselves in you. Then you wrote this book. How has the book been received? Have you gotten feedback from other people who said, yeah, that's my story too, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, you know, it hasn't been out that long, but, you know, there are quite a few people who read The Galleys and definitely gave me that kind of response already. And I'm, all, you know, the few people who have managed to read the whole thing in the last few days have already been giving me that kind of feedback that they see. And I knew that would happen because I started sharing these stories in my writing class a few years ago. I sort of, you know, just found myself telling them, you know, to reassure them that their experience wasn't uncommon. And, you know, they liked the stories, which was part of what emboldened me to write the book.
One of the things that I also found really interesting and kind of worthy of thought and contemplation for a lot of would-be writers was that not only do you find your voice, but you find your genre. And for some people, it might be memoir writing. For some people, it might be psychological thrillers and so on. But that's actually a process of discovery as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So after I was at the community college for 7 years or 6 years, I knew I had this sabbatical coming up and that I could apply for it. And I definitely wanted a year to go do something. And I, you know, had the idea I want to do a creative writing program. And I remember looking at programs and going, well, it's either poetry or fiction. This is 1997. And that's pretty much what existed. You know, there were very, very few creative nonfiction programs out there. So I was literally at that point knew so little about what I wanted to do that I thought, well, do I want to do poetry or do I want to do fiction? I was actually sort of torn. I thought, well, maybe what I want to do is poetry. And then I thought, well, no, it's probably closer to fiction. I knew I didn't make much up, but I thought, okay, I'll apply to a fiction writing program. And so I did, and I got in, and I found myself, you know, in a fiction writing program as somebody who doesn't make something much up. But the weird thing was I had the good luck of my very first professor was David Shields, who at that time, it was 1997, had just gone through this experience of he had started as a fiction writer and had written two or three books as fiction, and then he had gotten to a point like a year or two before I took his class where he had completely turned to nonfiction in his own writing. So in his class, I wrote one fiction story, and his comment was sort of something like, "Whoa, you know, I hope you can do something better than this." And then I said,
"Oh dear."
Yeah, well, or maybe something a little kinder. And then I was like, the next piece I wrote, I was like, no, I'll just write a personal essay about something, you know, excruciating, and just go for it. And that was the beginning of, okay, forget it. Forget fiction. Like, what I really need to be writing is about my own experiences and personal narrative. At that time, like, it was 1997, the memoir genre was just getting going. I think 2 years before Liars Club was published, a year earlier, Angela's Ashes was published. But, you know, a few years earlier than that, there was no memoir genre going. There was a few memoirs here and there, but it wasn't something like, oh, I'm going to go into memoir writing. That was a possibility. But, you know, I was kind of lucky because just as I was in the process of really starting to write, that genre became available in the culture, and then it was like a perfect match for what I wanted to do.
Theo Nestor is author of the new book, Writing is My Drink, a writer's story of finding her voice and a guide to how you can too. And indeed, it has lots of kind of exercises and things for people to try who are reading the book, as well as a wonderful story. She will be at Collected Works on Wednesday, December 4th at 6 o'clock for a reading, book signing, and a free writing class. And then on Friday, December 6th, she will be teaching the Black Mesa Writers Intensive. It's a one-day workshop here in Santa Fe at Bishop's Lodge. And the reason we're coming on the air so far in advance of the event is so that people can sign up. And if they want to sign up, they can go to, writingismydrink.com.
Perfect, yes. They'll see right at the top of the page a tab that says Black Mesa Writers Intensive. And just click on that, and all the details are there about the classes and the keynote speakers, which are Julia Cameron and Natalie Goldberg. And then in the morning, there's classes from myself, Tanya Taylor Rubenstein, who is a solo performance coach in Santa Fe and knows a great deal about writing your own story, and Candace Walsh, who is also a Santa Fe writer and author of Licking the Spoon, a memoir, and editor of two anthologies. One is Dear John, I Love Jane, and Ask Me About My Divorce.
That's right. And also a frequent guest on this show on Speaking of the Arts, Theo Pauline Nestor, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.